We're talking about miracles now. We had a fellow here about 4 years ago, and he was coming to the shiur, but he seemed to be very aloof. Remember, he set himself apart. Intelligent, came to the shiur, asked questions, but he had a kind of aloof. And finally, after a couple of months, I think it was, he asked to have an appointment to speak to me, and I agreed. So he came in, sat down, and he said, "Do you really believe in miracles?" I mean, he knew that I have a degree in philosophy, in particular in mathematical logic. "Do you really believe in miracles?" To him, that was unbelievable. It's just unbelievable. How could such a thing be? Here there's a terrific prejudice. To everybody tell somebody that you believe in miracles, for many people, that's going to be mind-boggling. I think when you meet with that kind of incredulity, when you meet with that kind of shock, what you ought to do is put the shoe on the other foot. You ought to say, "You believe in laws of nature that have no exceptions, never, anywhere, any exceptions? Why do you believe in that? Just because you've never seen any? Why would you believe that there are laws that don't have, not only don't have, can't have, they can't have any exceptions? What could possibly lead you to believe that there are laws which cannot have any exceptions? After all, how many exceptions are we claiming? We're not claiming that they happen every Monday and Thursday." Now, I want to describe to you the position of a very famous philosopher. I'm going to put it in fairly simple terms because it does capture the essence of the argument. Who said that you could never have any sufficient reason to believe in miracles. In other words, his idea is, I don't know whether they happened or not, but you couldn't possibly have enough reason to believe in them. Maybe they did happen, but then they're lost. It's not something that we could have reason to accept. His name was David Hume. He was a very great philosopher. Some of the things he said were wrong, but everything he said was clever, intelligent, you know. Now, here's one way to put his idea, and I'll show you where it goes wrong. But let's imagine that you're a judge, that you're in a court of law, and you're trying somebody on a crime. And there are witnesses who are going to go up and stand before you and give their testimony as to what happened. Let's suppose 3,000 witnesses all say that the crime took place. Let's say that 14 billion witnesses say the crime did not take place. What would you do then? 3,000 say it did take place, 14 billion say it did not take place. I think you'd probably say, 14 billion is a pretty big number, and if these 3,000 disagree, chances are they're making some kind of mistake. They have upset stomach, or they're suggestible, or they're not too intelligent, or they have a prejudice or something. But 3,000 against 14 billion, I mean, it's no contest. Certainly, I would believe the 14 billion and discard the 3,000. Okay, now, says you, think of where you sit. You look at the world around you, and always things happen in a regular way. Every time you put the raw egg into the boiling water, 5 minutes later it comes out hard-boiled. And every time you drop the raw egg, it lands on the floor and smashes. And every time you put the grass seed in the ground, and temperature's right, there's air, there's water, it grows. Right? You live in a world that's regular. Not only that, but you know, from talking to other people, that they live in a world that's regular also. Their lives are regular experience, and previous generations, millions and millions, billions and billions of people, their whole lives have been lives of regular experience. So if I take the experiences that have been regular, and 14 billion is much too conservative. You know, it's trillions and trillions, quadrillions and quadrillions of times when people have seen things go regular, ordinary, patterns, repetition over and over again. Now you have these people, these 3,000 people, who say they saw something special, extraordinary. What they're saying is going against trillions and trillions of witnesses who say that it doesn't happen. How could you ever accept what they say? You know, in terms of numbers, they're a tiny drop in the bucket. Even if it's 3 million people. It's 3 million against trillions and trillions. So you would have to say that these 3 million people are telling you that they heard a voice at Sinai, or they saw the Red Sea split, or whatever it is, as against the trillions and trillions of witnesses that are telling you that this sort of thing doesn't happen. You just have to discount them and say, I'm sorry, you know, you're just a drop in the bucket. And the vast, 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 vast majority of the testimony that I have to go on says no. That was Hume's argument. Are you with me? Does it sound persuasive? No? Why not?
Say that a little again. It doesn't mean that, you know, when everyone else saw that these eggs were falling every time that they weren't, they were.
Okay. This is the first point. This is a logically very important point. Listen to what he's saying. If you have 3,000 people that say, Tuesday afternoon in Dizengoff Square at 3 p.m., we saw Reuven kill Shimon. And you have 14 billion other people who say, at 3 p.m. in Dizengoff Square, we were there also, and we were watching the square, and no such thing happened. If there's a contradiction between what the 3,000 say and what the 14 billion say, you should definitely go with the 14 billion. That's correct. But over here, you don't have a contradiction. Because the 14 billion are talking about what happened at other times. Okay, let's take the splitting of the Red Sea. Okay? So now, a certain number of people say they were there and they saw it happen. Now Hume says, but consider all of the times when people look at the world and seas don't split. Those are other times. Okay?
But these 14 million people said that they saw at the same time they know about
Christ. No, then there aren't such 14 billion people. We're mixing up which stage of the argument we're up to. For Hume's argument to work, I would have to have the 14 billion present at exactly the same time, exactly the same place, and say, we were watching the same square that you were, and what you say didn't happen. Then Hume's argument would work. Okay? Now let's ask, what does Hume really have? In his application of the argument to miracles, what does he really have? Does he really have 14 billion people present at the same time in the same place, denying the same event? Is that what he's giving us? Certainly not. With respect to water splitting, where are the 14 billion that Hume appeals to? They're all over the world, at all of the different times, telling us that the Atlantic never split, and the Mediterranean never split, and the Pacific never split, and the Caspian Sea never split, and the Black Sea never split, right? Quite right. The Indian Ocean never split, correct? Correct. But they're not talking about the Red Sea 310 years ago when the Jews were there. They're talking about other seas and other places and other times. There are not 14 billion people together with the Jews there saying the Jews are not right. He's telling us about all the people who see regularity in their lives, in their places, and in their times. So he points out, they're not contradicting one another. Indeed, they could all be true. It could be true that at no other time, in no other place has a sea split, all the other seas stay stationary, and this sea split at this one time. They're not contradicting one another. If they're not contradicting one another, I don't have to choose between them. I can accept all of them. I can accept the 14 billion about the conditions that they're testifying, and I can accept the 3 million about the conditions they're testifying. Everybody can be right. The analogy to a courtroom where you have contradiction of testimony is not a good analogy at all. Because when you, in a courtroom, Yeah, I have to have contradiction about the same time, the same place, and the same event. And there you go with the majority of witnesses, especially if it's very lopsided, like 14 billion, you get 3 million. But here you don't have a contradiction. Is it clear now what I'm saying? Okay, now, suppose we try again for you. True, all the people who say that seas don't split are talking about the Atlantic, and they're talking about the Pacific, and they're talking about the Indian Ocean, they're talking about the Caspian Sea, and they're talking about 2,000 years ago, 1,000 years ago, last year, and 4,000 years ago, they're not talking about 3,310 years ago at the Red Sea with the Jews there. They're not talking about that. But, look what they're telling you. They're telling you the world is regular. The 14 billion all agree that the world is regular. And the 3 million are telling you that it's irregular. There's a contradiction. Okay, but now we're asking. Let me show you back to the beginning of you how the whole thing's set up. I'm sitting here in the 21st century. Now, I have a record that says 3 million people were standing by a sea and it split. If I take that record very seriously, it means there are 3 million people telling me they witnessed the sea split. Now, like any case of a witness, I have to make up my mind. Should I accept what he says or not? Witnesses don't always say things that are true. Sometimes they make honest mistakes. Sometimes they lie. Sometimes they're guided by their preconceptions. There are all kinds of reasons why what witnesses say may not be true. So I have to ask myself, is there any evidence on the other side against what they say? Now Hume says, yeah, you got 14 billion witnesses who disagree. That's what you have on the other side. So, our first question was, how do they disagree? So Hume says, well, look, these 14 billion witnesses are telling you that in all their times and places, seas never split. See, he points out, that's not a contradiction. They're saying in their times and places, the seas didn't split. The Jews are saying that in their one time and place, the seas did split. They could all be right. If they could all be right, then I don't have to choose between them. I can accept all of them. The analogy to a courtroom where you have witnesses contradicting one another is not a good analogy. Okay, so now let's try to rehabilitate Hume. Let's try to make Hume work again. Instead of having the 14 billion say, in the year 1942, I was standing by the Caspian Sea and it didn't split. In the year 1861, I was sailing the Pacific Sea and it didn't split. In the year 1006, I was sailing the Indian Ocean and it didn't split. Instead of having to say those things, which then there's no contradiction, right? Let's have each of the 14 billion say, we see a world that's regular, a world that's uniform, a world in which seas never split. We see a world in which seas never split. And the Jews are saying, no, this is a world in which the seas did split. Now we're contradicting one another.
But hold on, are those 14 billion people saying that the sea never split?
Oh.
Or saying that it never split when they were watching?
Correct. If what they say is the seas never split, then I will challenge them, you didn't see that. You didn't see that seas never split. All you saw was the sea didn't split today. You can say what you like, but generally you're not a witness anymore. A witness has to tell me what he sees. There's a thing in American court room procedure where you say to the witness he's not allowed to draw a conclusion. He's not allowed to draw a conclusion. All he can tell you is what he saw. What each of these witnesses saw is that in his specific conditions, the sea didn't split. I give him that. But if he goes on to say, I'm testifying that seas never split, that there are laws, and these laws are uniform and universal without exception, I declare him incompetent to make that statement. He doesn't see that there are laws. All he sees is particular events. So, there is a problem here. There's some difficulty here with Hume's argument. Well, what I'm telling you now is well known. If you look at any encyclopedia of philosophy, you'll find that these critiques of Hume's argument, even though at the outset it sounds so convincing. Another critique of Hume's argument, and he knows this, he puts the critique in, gives an answer, and I'll show you how the answer is not satisfactory for us, is this. According to Hume's argument with the witnesses against the witnesses, could you ever discover anything really new? Really new. Really, really brand new. So Hume considers the possibility of witnesses coming and telling us that 300 years ago, there were 8 days of darkness. 8 days where everything was done. Maybe in a particular place where they were. That's assumed. You might think we can make the same sort of argument over again. These 3,000 people are telling you in their place, in their time, there are 8 days of darkness. And everybody else is telling you it's 24 hours, 12 hours of this and 12 hours of that. Okay, winter, summer, a little longer, a little shorter. But it's always a 24-hour rotation, part light, part dark. And therefore, I have 14 billion against 3,000, and I'm going to throw out the 3,000. Hume says, no, maybe, in a case like this, you could accept the testimony of the 3,000. Because, he says, we know from experience that the conditions of light and darkness are subject to all sorts of factors, clouds and the way the sunlight comes in and smoke and dust in the air, and we know that we don't really understand what controls all these things. Maybe a volcanic eruption could, as some now do say, that volcanic eruptions could cause the earth to go pretty dark for a long period of time, could kill out large swaths of life. He says, look, from our own experience we know that in this area the world is liable to be variable. It's liable to change. It's liable to fluctuate. So here, maybe we would be able to accept it on the grounds that although we never heard of anything like this, but the whole area is an area which our experience teaches us could change. And since it could change, when these people say it did change at a particular time, we could accept it. In other words, if there's an analogy to my experience, some kind of analogy, either an analogy of the particular thing they're talking about, 8 days of darkness. Maybe once upon a time we know of a case where there were 36 hours of darkness. We missed one 12-hour day period. So listen, you know, we had it once for 36 hours. You say 8 days, so, you know, we didn't ever see 8 days. We saw 36 hours, so, you know, maybe it could be longer. Some kind of analogy. If the category that they're giving testimony to has a relationship to my experience, then perhaps I could accept what they say. But he says, in the case of these blatant miracles, there's no relationship to my experience at all. Never does water stand up by itself. Not even a little bit of water in your glass, you know. So, it's just something which could never be accepted. No matter how many witnesses you had, you could never accept it. Now, poor Hume lived at a time when modern science was just beginning. And therefore, he didn't ever have the chance to experience some of the really new stuff that that science provides us with. But anybody who knows something about the 20th century science is aware that science is now producing things, has produced things, that are totally different from everything that we experience, and every category of everything that we experience, and have no connections whatsoever. I read about this a couple of years ago, and you saw this in your science classes in high school. But I am told that this is an experiment that is done quite regularly in high school science now, to take a drop of water and suspend it in the air with magnets. The drop of water will just sit in the air with nothing holding it up except magnets. And of course, with magnets, you don't see the magnetic field, you just see some pieces of, you know, some pieces of stone or whatever it is, some hard object, and then water sits there. Water molecules are not magnetically neutral. They're shaped a little bit like a triangle, like this, and one end is positive, the other end is negative. And because of that, water has magnetic properties. And you can hold a droplet of water in the air. More than that, if you have strong magnets, you can do it with a small frog. And they have done this. You just set up the magnets, you take the frog, and you let go, and he doesn't fall. He just hangs there in the air, because there's a lot of water in the frog. And since you can set up this magnetic effect in water, there's enough water in the frog to hold the frog above the tip. And he just sits there in the air, above the tip. Now, I think, according to Hume, no one should ever believe this. I don't care if it's printed in the science books, and I don't care if you read about it on the internet, you should never believe it, because nowhere in your experience ever has it happened that a frog or anything like a frog, when you let go of it, sits there. It just doesn't do that. Or the example that I gave to some of you the other day, if you want to throw a ball, and you want to throw it as far as possible, one thing you do is you take a running start. Right? You run, and then at the maximum speed of running, you throw it. Why? What good does a running do? Well, because if I can throw a ball at 10 miles an hour, and I can run at 5 miles an hour, so if I'm running at 5 miles an hour, and then I throw it at 10, the ball will be going at, you don't need a calculator for that, do you? 15 miles an hour. Right? Just add my running to the strength with which I can throw the ball, and you get 15. Now, that's true throughout our experience. Shoot bullets, sound waves, whatever you like. Except for one thing. Except for light. When you measure a light ray going past you, it always goes past at the same speed. No matter whether the source is moving towards you, or moving away from you, or standing still. That's the way it happened. Very strange. Very strange. There's nothing in our experience that remotely resembles that. In fact, everything in our experience directly contradicts it. And therefore, according to Hume, you should never accept it. No matter how many scientists tell it to you, you should never accept it. Because let's say you have 10,000 scientists all over the world who claim to have measured it in a laboratory. But there are 14 billion witnesses telling you it doesn't happen. So the 10,000 just can't measure against the 14 billion. But of course, as you know very well, we do accept it. So there's got to be something wrong with Hume's argument.
Well, we can throw up a second argument of Hume's regarding the light or suspending the water.
Say again, I'm not getting you.
Like second, if in certain situations it happens, we would accept it, right?
But according to him, you should never accept it because you have the whole experience of all mankind that this doesn't happen against it.
Nothing you could come in into the light, new like inventions, whatever. Like,
so this is what he says. It can only be new if it fits into a category where your experience already tells you this sort of thing could happen. Like 8 days of darkness.
It cannot change. I can't see.
Well, that's right. Otherwise, you could get miracles in also. And he wants to keep miracles out. So you got to have the category static and say, if it doesn't fit into the categories that we already experienced, then it's absolutely impossible to accept. Which means you can't accept anything really new, really, really blatantly new, that has no connection with your categories whatsoever. The whole of modern science in the 20th century talks about things, and they stress, the scientists stress, this has no analogy to your everyday experience. No analogy whatsoever. Things happen in ways that just, according to everyday experience, can't happen. But they do anyway. Yeah?
Hume himself is the one who said that the laws of science are just because that's what we've seen until now. There's no reason for it, so why couldn't they just change?
The laws could change. It doesn't say the laws can't change. This says that when they change, they have to change by analogy to some aspect of your experience. That's what would lead you to change them. What would lead you to change them is some analogy to your experience. Right? But if it's too different from everything you've always experienced, then at least if other people tell you about it, you'd never have a reason to accept it. He doesn't mention, as I remember, he doesn't mention what you should do if you yourself saw it. Now here you could go two ways. You could say, well, if I saw it, you know, so then for me it's okay. Or you could say, I must be hallucinating if I saw it. I mean, what would you think if after three martinis you saw a pink elephant walking in through the door? You wouldn't say, well, I see it. You'd say, that's what you get for drinking three martinis. Right? So you come to doubt your own ability to perceive what's going on. Yeah.
Wouldn't that destroy all of the scientific advancements anyway? Like things like the Industrial Revolution, the Iron Age. Because people before then didn't see these things. So all of a sudden now you have science, and now you have technology. Confused
as we
go, didn't exist 30 years ago,
so why should anyone who lived 30 years ago believe that they exist now? Well, you see, again, go back to his example of 8 days of darkness. Now, you imagine a population of people who have never seen 8 days of darkness and up until now have never heard of it. Now 3,000 people come from Turkey and say, oh, come on. 250 years ago, you know, in Turkey, there were 8 days of darkness. Hume says they could accept it. They could accept it. Why? Because they know very well that weather patterns change and that clouds can affect and soot and dust can affect. And, you know, and these things are not very well understood as to when they come and why they come. So there's already room in your experience to see that this kind of thing could be different. So there's an analogy to your experience, even though it's not something you directly witnessed. Right? But there's an analogy. But I'll give you in advance, I mean, I didn't use this before, but maybe it's an even simpler example. Let's imagine the first person who discovers a magnet. Now, I suppose you've all done this when you were kids. You know, you have a nail on the floor, and you take the magnet, and then you lower the magnet very slowly to the nail, and when it gets close enough, then the nail jumps up to the magnet. Now imagine reporting that to other people. You'll never guess what happened to me. This is really amazing. You know, I took the thing, and I went down and down and down, and then it jumped up. The nail! You know, just a nail. So of course, the first guy will say, you know, what have you been drinking? Or what have you been shooting at you? You know, what have you been sniffing? I mean, I can't, come on, don't leave me alone. Don't bother me with this guy's nonsense. But suppose 10 or 15 people tell you, people who are ordinarily serious, conscientious people, and they say, this guy discovered something new. It's some kind of rock that makes nails jump, right? According to Hume, since nails never jump, pieces of metal, inanimate metal, never jump on their own, according to Hume, we should never accept this. Never. It should be inconceivable that you should accept it. But here's an example. I think you're right. I don't think Hume's argument makes room for that kind of a dance, because it has no connection to your experience whatsoever. So Hume's argument, which ignorant people will use as very powerful a reason not to believe in miracles, as you see, is really not a powerful argument at all. And that it's if you're open to discovering new things in science, new things that are really very strange and very paradoxical, without any connection to your experience at all, then you can understand how it would be possible for a miracle also. That's one argument. Gosh, only one person's asleep. That means that must be doing pretty well. One more shot at philosophy. I can't resist this. That's getting my background. Let's suppose somebody told you that your car is at home, and that one of your tires is flat. Gosh, nuts. That's going to change the tire. It's going to cost me an extra hour. Suppose somebody told you that your car has turned into a camel. Would you worry about the insurance? I don't think so. What you would say is, you'll pardon me, but I'm a little cautious about your report, because that's not the sort of thing that usually happens, you know. Maybe it happened, but I'm going to need a lot more evidence than you're saying something. Is today poor me? Or April 1st? You know, why are you saying this? There is something called the antecedent probability. The probability a thing has before you get the evidence. How likely is it? If somebody tells you something happened, or gives you evidence something happened, the first question you ask yourself is, what kind of thing are we talking about? Are we talking about the kind of thing that happens regularly? Which means, given everything I know, it's quite reasonable for things like this to happen. Of course, it shouldn't happen to me, flat tires, but they can happen to other people. And, you know. If the thing itself is the kind of thing that you feel is reasonably probable, it's the kind of thing which normally and naturally happens. That doesn't mean all the time. 10% of the time, 5% of the time, 1 in 20, 2% of the time, 1 in 50. It's reasonable, it's normal, especially in a big population of people. 1 in 50 would not be quite often. Then the amount of evidence you need is not so great. the more likely it is, before you get the evidence, the less evidence you need to convince you that it really happened. Whereas, instead of going to the camel, let me make it more simple, more direct. The second report is that all four of your tires are flat. I've had flat tires when I used to own a car. It happens. When I used to own a car, the top life of a tire was 5 years. After that, they said it's going to fall apart. So now they have the life of your car is the life of your tire. Right? It's a different world. If somebody told me my car at home is a flat tire, I'd be inclined to accept it. If somebody tells me at home that all my tires are flat, I'd be very skeptical. Why? Because all four tires going flat at the same time is very unlikely, because it very rarely happens. Then, however, if three or four people came to me and said, my gosh, we just went past your house and all four of your tires are flat, then I'd have to face it and say that probably it's right. The more unlikely the thing is to happen in general, the more evidence I need to accept that it happened in this case. Now they say, take something which is against the laws of nature. How likely is that to happen? Well, go back to the 14 billion. Not as witnesses now, contradicting one another. But the 14 billion tell you they never saw this happen. Which means I have loads and loads and loads of experiences where this never happens. Now, somebody tells me it did happen on one occasion, because I have so much experience with this not happening, seems that I would need an awful lot of evidence to convince me that it did happen. The more unlikely it is, in general, for X to happen, the more evidence I need in this particular case that X happened. I saw once a film of a full court basket made 2 seconds before the end of the game. It was unbelievable. This guy had the ball down at the end of his court. There was 2 seconds left. What could he do? So he threw the ball at the other basket and swish went through the other basket. What's the probability of that? It's pretty low. It's pretty low. At the other end of the court, if you tried with the best possible shooter, you wouldn't make 1 in 100. So if it's very improbable that the thing should happen, then I'm going to need more and more evidence to convince me it did happen. Now the argument will be, from the uniform experience of mankind that seas don't part, you would need a mountain of evidence, to overcome that statement that the seas did part. Now the question is whether 3 million witnesses is a mountain of evidence. And here again the person might say, look, it's 3 million against 14 billion, not as witnesses now, but just as setting how likely it is for that thing to happen before I consider the evidence. A three-legged chicken. They report that a farm in Utah, on a chicken farm in Utah, was hatched a three-legged chicken. I said, all the chickens in the world, which have got to be millions and millions and millions, no one ever reported a three-legged chicken. How much evidence would I have to go against all those millions and millions? Wouldn't it have to be a gigantic amount of evidence? Do we ever have that much evidence? Now again, this sounds like a reasonable argument. We do, pretty much, weigh up how much evidence we need on the basis of how unlikely the thing was to happen. But then, when you come to real cases, it doesn't seem to work that way. In certain real cases, I don't know if you saw this, I think it was about 4 years ago, in Time magazine, in the Midwestern United States, was born what are called conjoined twins. These are not Siamese twins. Conjoined twins means you have one body with two heads. One body with two heads. And they show this, these are two girls, I think they were about 6 at the time when the story was done. And you saw an x-ray, and you could see two spines, melding into one spine. There's a heart, as I remember it, with if I remember correctly, 6 chambers. The right head has control of the right side of the body. The left head has control of the left side of the body. Can you imagine learning to walk when you have control of one leg and the other one has control of the other leg? They said it was quite a while before they learned to coordinate the walking. And using 2 hands together. And at the time they did the interview, the right head wanted to be a doctor and the left head wanted to be an airline pilot. They did their homework separately. They didn't cheat on tests. You know, they took the answers to the exams. They looked at their own paper. You know, 2 personalities. 2 personalities, 2 heads, 1 body. Now, I must tell you, there is such a Gemara. There's a Gemara in Bechoros. What happens if an animal is born with 2 heads? Is it 1 Bechor? Is it 2 Bechoros? You have to pay twice or pay once. Which way do you do it? When I read that Gemara, when I was becoming frum, it pushed me over the edge. I said, you know, come on. Don't be. And then, you know, you could say, maybe it's just theoretical. No, but the Gemara says there were such cases. And I, in my great experience of 20 years, said there couldn't be such a thing. But when I saw the picture in Time magazine, I was instantly convinced. They all did one picture. I didn't have 3 million people saying they saw it. I had a reporter for Time magazine. That's all. Why didn't I say it was a fraud? Why didn't everybody say it was a fraud? Why didn't people say it can't be? Because none of us has ever experienced anything like that. Because it's Time magazine. Because our world has in it lots and lots of things we don't know. So in the back of our minds, we are sort of expecting new things to happen. That has happened to us in the past. New things happen. New things that were totally unexpected, that have no relationship to my experience at all. That have no analogy to my experience at all. The one analogy they have is that they don't have any analogy. They're brand new. When you get used to this, to hearing and reading and experiencing things that are brand new, the next brand new thing isn't so shockingly improbable. I was alive in 1969 when men first walked on the moon. Why did anybody believe that? Man on the moon? 15 years before, nobody was even dreaming about it. In 69, they did it. Because we're used to new things happening. Our minds are much more open to novelties. So when you try to assess how probable is it that something will happen, you have to be very careful to take everything into account. Including the fact that I know how ignorant we are about what's going on. And that new things are being discovered quite regularly. And therefore, if the reporter is reliable, and on something like this, I assume that the New York Times is reliable, Time magazine is reliable. So, one reporter with a few pictures is enough to convince me. Even though we know what the photo op can do. You know what the programs can do. You've been creating false pictures and everything else. It's a cinch to make pictures like that without it being real. But Time magazine wouldn't do that. What do I have more experience of? All the people that have been born in the history of the world are Time magazine. Probably more experience of all the people born in the history of the world. And that should make it overwhelmingly improbable. How can one reporter in one magazine do such a job on everybody? Because we know that these things are usually reliable. So the whole starting point that a report of a miracle would go against the experience of everybody, and therefore you couldn't ever get enough evidence to overcome the initial improbability, is simply not correct. More than that, we're talking now about things that happen with no reason. Two-headed, one-bodied pair of people. But what about the report of a miracle? We started the week by saying that a miracle is an event in which you can see God's agency. It's not just a blick. It's not just a quirk. It's not just something which, you know, the Parker pen floating in the air. Now, for many people, the idea that the world as a whole is an accident is really very unreasonable. The whole world is an accident? Just an accident. Didn't have to be this way, could have been anyway, it's just this way by accident. For many people, that idea itself is unreasonable. If that idea is unreasonable, if you take it as quite reasonable that the universe displays intelligence, planning, coordination of some kind, then the idea that that intelligence would communicate to us is not such a terribly foreign idea. It's not such a terribly outrageous idea. It's not like a three-legged chicken or a two-headed, one-body persons. It's something which is fairly reasonable. I don't say it's necessary. Some people want to tell you if the intelligence created, he wouldn't do it for nothing, and then he would talk to us. I don't know if that's necessary, but it certainly isn't outrageous. Call it 5%. But for something which I give a 1 in 20 chance, I don't need an overwhelming amount of evidence to say that it happened. It doesn't have to be such a great amount of evidence. What, that's 2, 4, 8, 16, 5, less than 5 flips on a coin coming up heads. How many witnesses would you need to tell you that 5 flips in a row came up heads? 2? So, what I'm saying is 2 things. Number one, even if intuitively the antecedent probability is very low, we do trust sources of information to tell us these things happen, even when it's very low. And number two, I don't think it's so low. Yes, if you think that the parting of the Red Sea is equivalent to a three-legged chicken, then the antecedent probability would be very low. But I don't think that's a fair analogy. Parting of the Red Sea is the intelligence that's responsible for the world communicating with us. I think that's a lot more probable than a three-legged chicken. I think it's a reasonable idea. I don't think it, in terms of logic, it has to happen, but it certainly is a reasonable thing to happen. And if it's a reasonable thing to happen, then no reason why we have to rule it out as something which is impossible in principle. Okay? So I've been going through the literature recently. I went through, there's a very nice internet encyclopedia of philosophy called the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. And it has an article on miracles. So I went through the article, and this was the key skeptical argument, was Hume's argument. And these two features were the two key skeptical features. And the author of the article himself points out that these features are not certainly not crippling, and that I believe the miracles can survive this kind of skeptical philosophy. You with me? One last thing. I don't know if you've seen the series of books called Small Miracles. It's really quite an interesting series, put together by two religious women, Jewish religious women, collecting stories of incidents that, if they happened to any of us, we would immediately say it was divine providence. These stories happen to a wide variety of people, some Jewish, some non-Jewish, men, women, children. I don't have 4 or 5 volumes already, hundreds of stories of events which are so improbable that, as I said, we, if they happened to us, we would immediately say it was divine providence. Now, the question arises, and I told somebody about these books, he asked me, do we believe that God would do those kinds of miracles for non-Jews? To teach them something, or to illustrate something to them, or whatever. I thought that was a good question. I was around asking people. The only person to give me, one person in my respect said yes, but couldn't give me a proof. The only person who said yes and gave me a proof was my Rebbe, who instantly said, yes, we know it's from the plagues in Egypt. So I stupidly said, but the plagues in Egypt were for us. They were to take us out of Egypt. So look in Exodus and see. It says, in order for the Egyptians to know that there is none like me in all the earth. That's one of the reasons for the plagues. To teach the Egyptians who's who. That's what it says right there in the book. God says, I'm doing this so the Egyptians will know. Later I discovered a Ramban. You know that Cain killed Hevel. And then God cursed Cain. So then Cain said, you know, I'm going to be a wanderer and a vagabond and everyone will kill me. So it says God made a sign for Cain that he won't be killed. And Ramban says something fast. What kind of sign did he make? So, you know, I don't know if you've heard it in literature, stuff with the mark of Cain on the forehead, you know, whatever, a burnt in K or something. That's crazy literature. Says Ramban, every time Cain went out on a trip, God performed for him a visible miracle so that he would have the confidence to be able to take the trip and know he wasn't going to be killed. Unbelievable. Every time he took a trip, God performed some kind of miracle for him so that he would have the confidence to be able to take the trip and know he wouldn't be killed.
I tell you, if you look
at in the Sharat Mu, in the Sharat Shuba of the Ben Yonah, you'll see that he did Shuba. And since he did Shuba, it took off the death sentence and half of the sentence of Esau. And Ben Yonah uses this as an example of what Shuba can do. Anyway, but he does a miracle for him. God did miracles for Sanherib on his way to Yerushalayim, to conquer Yerushalayim. He didn't conquer it in the end, but on the way, it says the Jordan dried up for him, and he crossed the river dry, started out wet, and became dry. He had several miracles on the way to conquer. So the idea that God will do miracles for non-Jews is definitely an idea that we could accept. And here, in these books, you have, they call them small miracles, you know, they don't change the whole world. But for these people in their lives, the things that happened were so outstandingly improbable that they experienced it as miracles. And having read some of the volumes, the stories are really astonishing. They are really astonishing. So, I think we're well within our rights to accept the idea that there are miracles. Certainly the large miracles that the Jewish tradition tells us about. And, as is quite likely, small miracles in the lives of many, many people. Okay.